This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Billionaire Richard Branson's Virgin Orbit aims to reach space for the first time on Sunday by launching a rocket from midair. This latest attempt is key after the rocket's first test launch was aborted last year. If conditions on Sunday hold, the company's 70-foot Launcher 1 rocket will be dropped from the wing of a modified Boeing 747 at 40,000 feet in the air. The rocket will then ignite its engine to pierce Earth's atmosphere and attempt to deliver 10 small satellites to orbit for NASA. The window for the launch test from Southern California begins on Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Virgin executives say high-altitude launches allow satellites to be placed in their intended orbit more efficiently and also minimize weather-related cancellations compared to more traditional rockets launched vertically from a ground pad. Iran urged the United Nations nuclear watchdog to avoid publishing unnecessary details on Tehran's nuclear program, state TV reported on Sunday, a day after Germany, France, and Britain said Tehran has no credible civilian use for its development of uranium metal. The report quoted a statement from Iran's nuclear department that asked the International Atomic Energy Agency to avoid publishing details on Iran's nuclear program that may cause confusion. On Saturday, Germany, France, and Britain pressed Iran to back off its plan to develop uranium metal, a violation of its 2015 nuclear deal with world powers. The goal of the deal is to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear bomb, something Iran insists it does not want to do. On Thursday, the IAEA said Iran made it aware of their intention to produce uranium metal for an improved type of fuel. This is VOA News. Leading Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny departed from Germany on Sunday to return to Russia, where he faces the threat of arrest after recovering from his poisoning in August with a nerve agent. Navalny said he was very happy as he boarded a plane in Berlin bound for Moscow. It remains to be seen what reception awaits him there. On Thursday, Russia's prison service said that he faces immediate arrest once he returns. Navalny, who has blamed his poisoning on the Kremlin, charged that Russian President Vladimir Putin was now trying to deter him from coming home with new legal motions. The Kremlin has repeatedly denied a role in the opposition leader's poisoning. UN peacekeeping troops say they have retaken control of a city in the Central African Republic captured 2 weeks ago by armed groups waging an offensive against the government. Rebels abandoned their positions in Bangassou, 750 kilometers east of the capital Bangui, and fled the city following an ultimatum on Friday from the UN peacekeeping force known as MINUSCA, according to the force's spokesman late Saturday. Armed groups waging a nationwide offensive captured the city on January 3rd, forcing many residents to flee to the Democratic Republic of Congo. A spokesman for MINUSCA's military component said the UN force intervened to stop attempts at looting overnight Friday to Saturday. Landlocked CAR is one of the world's poorest nations and has seen a string of coups and wars since it gained independence from France in 1960. Indonesia's emergency agency said Sunday that the death toll from Friday's 6.2 magnitude earthquake now stands at 73. The agency said more than 820 people were injured and over 27,800 left their homes after the earthquake. Some sought refuge in the mountains, while others went to cramped evacuation centers. A spokesman for the agency added that police and military officers have been deployed to crack down on looting in several parts of the affected region. An emergency response status intended to help rescue efforts has also been put in place for 2 weeks. Meanwhile, the head of Indonesia's meteorological agency has said that another quake in the region could potentially trigger a tsunami. Straddling the so-called Pacific Ring of Fire, Indonesia is regularly hit by earthquakes. For more on these and other stories making international news headlines, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
A journey of 100 kilometers. There are fears of kidnappers. There are fears of bandits. And this is happening across the entire nation. It's no longer limited to geopolitical zones.
Nigeria's main opposition party, PDP, criticizes the government over growing insecurity concerns.
On the Zondo Commission, which is the state capture commission, it is the single biggest step we have taken to fight corruption as a country. But the commission is as good as the report it produces. And that report, we are still awaiting.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa plans to step away if he faces graft charges.
UNHCR is trying together with partners to actually decongest these border areas due to the fact that we don't want refugees to be residing so close to the border. So we have relocated about 20,000 to the Umrak Fuba area, and we are about now to relocate the rest to the Teneba area.
And the United Nations and its partners rushed to relocate thousands of refugees camping along the Sudan-Ethiopia border. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, says it appears the government is admitting defeat in the face of increasing insecurity. This after local media quoted Femi Adesina, a spokesperson for President Muhammadu Buhari, as saying Nigerians who fail to commit the security situation in the hands of God could be guilty of indirectly prolonging the war against the insurgency. The opposition party condemned Adesina's statement as tasteless and regrettable. The party says the statement is an admission of defeat. This after local media reports that militants from the Islamic State West Africa Province, or ISWAP, have captured a military base in Borno State. Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the opposition PDP. He tells me that Adesina's statement about the escalating insecurity situation in Nigeria is troubling.
Well, the assertion by the presidency that Nigerians should wait on God for a solution to the insecurity problem in our country is an admission of failure by the President Muhammadu Buhari administration. It has shown clearly to Nigerians that we should not put our hopes on the administration to resolve the situation in which we have found our nation. And it is really disappointing that a presidency that earned the people's vote and who swore to an oath of office to defend the territorial integrity of our nation, to protect lives and property, will turn around and ask Nigerians to look unto God for solution. It is totally, totally disappointing.
But officials of the administration are saying the government has stepped up efforts to protect life and property, to defeat Boko Haram, and to sharply reduce violence carried out by militant groups. And that they said the results are there for all Nigerians to see. What do you say to that?
It is instructive to note that the Buhari presidency acts as if it is not in sync with the reality of our nation. It will amount to foolhardiness for anybody to claim that the security situation in which we have found ourselves has improved in the last 6 years. If anything, it has worsened. Prior to 2015, the insurgency, particularly from the Boko Haramists, have been fought to the fringes of the Northeast. But what do we find today in our nation? Bandits, kidnappers, vandals are on the prowl. And it appears that the government is helpless. The situation has reached a stage in which Nigerians including the two parliamentary houses of our nation, has called on Mr. President to review his parade and to rejig the security architecture of our nation. But what we find is this blunt arrogance of "we have done it" in inverted commas, whereas they have done nothing. And it's even unfortunate.
Some Nigerians are calling for all the service chiefs to be replaced or fired and new ones appointed. Is that the stance also of the PDP?
The People's Democratic Party had consistently demanded for the rejigging of security architecture. And that had also been the position of many Nigerians. Now, when the president failed to rejig the security architecture, the People's Democratic Party had demanded that it should relieve the service chiefs of their respective positions and bring in fresh and new hands, because it appears that those in charge currently have become war-fatigued. And since they are fighting an asymmetry war, and it appears that they are losing men and resources, it was needful for Mr. President, as a commander-in-chief and as a general, to look inwards and see new people that they can bring in to manage the situation. However, the sing-song on the street of Nigerians today is that if President Muhammadu Buhari refused to remove those service chiefs, the service chiefs themselves, having seen that they are outliving their usefulness in their various arms, could also speak to the president and ask that they want to leave office to enable younger people who are versatile to take charge of their respective departments.
Where do Nigerians go from here, particularly with what you described as the worsening situation of security across the country?
Today, Nigerians have become despondent. They have discovered that the government have nothing to offer and that it has failed to fulfill even the littlest of the promises that President Muhammadu Buhari made to Nigerians, either in 2015 or in 2019. On account of this, the people have become despondent, they have resigned to fate, in a situation where a journey of 200 kilometers, a journey of 100 kilometers, there are fears of kidnappers, there are fears of bandits, and this is happening across the entire nation. It's no longer limited to geopolitical zones.
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition party, the PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa says he will step away if he was charged with corruption. This after a former CEO of Eskom, an energy company, accused Ramaphosa of involvement in the irregular awarding of contracts during his tenure. He has also accused the president of conflict of interest at the time. Mr. Ramaphosa rejects the accusations as without merit. South Africans have been calling for investigations into public officials accused of corruption in an effort to reduce graft. For the latest development in the fight against corruption in South Africa, I reached Tanyiko Maluleka, a senior research fellow at the University of Pretoria Center for the Advancement of Scholarship.
The allegation itself is not completely new. He has been accused of this before, and he denies it, but promises that should he be charged, he will step aside as required by his party, which is a bit alarming for a president of the country to say, but within the context of the allegations, it makes sense that he says that.
But how are South Africans reacting to his statement?
The rule is that you step aside once you have been charged formally. Until now, he has not been charged formally with corruption. These are only allegations. Should the next step be taken that he be charged formally, he promises to step aside at that point. I think that most South Africans would expect him to do that because it's what he has been asking other people in his party to do. But I think he is confident, it seems to me, that it will not be necessary because he denies all these allegations. But just in case he is charged, he is prepared to do what he has been asking other people to do, namely to step aside.
Do South Africans believe in the fight against corruption and that those who are alleged to have committed all kinds of corruption within the ruling ANC and by extension who have significant impact in the way government runs businesses are being held accountable for their actions?
Corruption is a big problem in South Africa. Corruption is a big problem in Africa. In fact, corruption is a big problem in the world. And so South Africa has been battling with this, and that's why we now have a commission of inquiry into a particular type of corruption, which has been named state capture, as an attempt to try and fight corruption. Cyril Ramaphosa, upon ascending the position of president, promised to fight corruption. And this stepping aside is one of the things that have been recommended at conference which he was elected as chair as a means of fighting corruption. So corruption coexists with the current government. There are attempts to fight it. How successful these attempts will be, we will have to wait and see.
But what about the fight against corruption in South Africa? Do you think it has been successful so far? Has the investigation into allegations of corruption been robust? Have the institutions been effective so far, if I may ask you?
Well, the most important step South Africa has taken in fighting corruption since independence is the appointment of this commission that is currently sitting. And this commission is still in the middle of its task. So we must wait until it gives us its report. But this, to my mind, is the biggest single thing South Africa has done to fight systemic corruption. There were other commissions that were appointed, like the Seriti Commission, which was appointed to look into the arms deal. The report of that commission has largely been dismissed as ineffectual. So one hopes that this state capture commission will make a difference and will build confidence that the government, the ruling party, is serious about fighting corruption. I must say that commissions before now have not been very successful because the Seriti Commission was not very successful. The Marikana Commission was not very successful either after the shooting of the miners. So all hopes are hanging on the Zondo Commission, which is the state capture commission. It is the single biggest step we have taken to fight corruption as a country. But the commission is as good as the report it produces. And that report we are still awaiting.
Tinyiko Maluleka is a senior research fellow at the University of Pretoria Center for the Advancement of Scholarship. He spoke with me from the South African capital, Pretoria. The Zimbabwean government says it's recovered more than $2 million in property and vehicles worth $1.5 million from former high-ranking government officials, including cabinet ministers, convicted of amassing ill-gotten assets. For VOA, Adegondo gives us more on the recent developments.
The recent revelations from the Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission follow Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube's budget presentation in November when he said the government would begin going after illicitly acquired wealth. The effort is being spearheaded by a team comprising Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission members along with the Reserve Bank and the National Prosecuting Authority. Those who have had properties confiscated include self-exiled Foreign Affairs Minister Walter Mzembe and former Police Commissioner General Augustine Chiuri. graft and corruption have been cited as a major factor in Zimbabwe's economic downturn over the years. The ruling ZANU-PF party blames Western-imposed sanctions. A report by Transparency International in Zimbabwe indicated that corruption has permeated all levels of society, with 70% of the people who were surveyed saying they had to pay bribes to get basic documents such as passports, for example. Fadzai Jegemu, legal and policy officer at Transparency International Zimbabwe, cautiously welcomed the ongoing anti-corruption drive.
The three institutions, Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission, Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, and the National Prosecuting Authority, managed to seize properties and cars worth 2 billion. And Transparency International Zimbabwe applauds the institutions for doing that. What remains important for Transparency International at the moment is the fact that we need to respond to the then what question at this juncture. After seizing the proceeds of corruption, then what? How are these going to be managed? We have to follow again the proceeds which we followed before.
JKM warned against political opportunism being used to target political opponents in the current exercise. She underscored that Zimbabwe signed and ratified the United Nations Convention Against Corruption.
To say these institutions, as they are following the money, they should be very impartial. They should have a mantra, no to impunity.
While the anti-corruption team wants to recover US $7.4 million from high-ranking officials, economic analyst Gift Mugano says it is difficult to establish how much the country is losing to graft and corruption, with recent high-profile arrests for gold smuggling, for example.
It's very difficult to come up with the exact figure as to how much the country has lost, because it happened in secret.
Mugano says institutions that collect revenue and deal with white-collar crime must be capacitated to be effective in the current anti-corruption drive.
There are structural issues which are related to weak institutions. Look at Central Bank as an example. They have no capacity to establish the real cost of a particular commodity which is being imported, because most of the transfer pricing happens when you are importing a particular commodity. So it is overstated. Or when you are exporting, the prices are understated, and to some extent that you don't then know what will be the correct price.
The Anti-Corruption Commission says it's determined to pursue illicitly acquired wealth of fed cats beyond the country's borders.
Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Zimbabwe.
The United Nations and other agencies are rushing to relocate thousands of refugees camped out along the disputed Sudan-Ethiopia border to safer areas further away. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Tensions along the border region between Sudan and Ethiopia have grown since the conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray province started in early November. Since then, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees estimates that more than 58,000 Ethiopian refugees have fled for safety across the border into Sudan. The agency reports between 200 and 500 refugees continue to arrive every day at two border crossings. UNHCR representative in Sudan, Axel Bishop, has just returned from a mission to East Sudan. He says the UNHCR is moving the refugees to designated settlements farther from the border, where they will be safer and have better living conditions.
UNHCR is trying together with partners to actually decongest these border areas due to the fact that we don't want refugees to be residing so close to the border. So we have relocated about 20,000 to the Umrah Quba area, and we are about now to relocate the rest to the Taniba area.
The Umrah Quba camp is about 70 kilometers from the border. It was constructed shortly after the refugee influx began in early November. In less than 2 months, it had reached its capacity of 20,000 refugees. Bishop says the new Tuna Bay site, which is around 137 kilometers farther from the border, was opened January 3rd to handle the overflow.
The Taniba site is a site which has been developed on an area which is very, very remote. And at the moment, we don't have any electricity there. We have pitched tents, and we are trying, and we're actually racing against the clock here to get a camp up and running. At the moment, we have moved about 5,000 people there, but we expect to actually move about 20,000 additional people there.
Getting to the camp is very difficult. Bishop says it can take up to 15 hours of travel over rough terrain to reach the site from the border. He says aid agencies are now setting up shelters and infrastructure. He says health care, water, and food are available for the refugees. As more refugees arrive, though, more relief will be needed. He says additional funding is required to quickly set up the remaining services and to ensure the increasing needs of the Ethiopian refugees are being met. He is calling for more support from international donors, noting only 33% of the UN's $147 million appeal so far has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, warns that swarms of desert locusts are returning to the Horn of Africa just 1 year since the worst invasion in 70 years. A senior FAO official told VOA that immature swarms formed in eastern Ethiopia and central Somalia in December have migrated to southern Ethiopia and northern Kenya. For VOA, Ruben Chiama reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Around this time last year, swarms of desert locusts began spreading across the Horn of Africa, devastating crops and livelihoods. Now, officials say another infestation is endangering the region's food security situation again. Cyril Ferrand is FAO's resilience team leader in East Africa.
The region is therefore facing a new breeding generation, and the most affected countries are Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia at the moment. The situation is, of course, very serious and very critical, and it will remain so until the end of the upsurge. However, comparing to the situation a year ago, swarms are much smaller and are identified rapidly thanks to better surveillance capacities in the region.
A UN impact assessment carried out recently in Ethiopia, Kenya and Somalia found that half of pastoralist communities and about a third of farming households suffered losses after the desert locusts destroyed crops and pastures. Ferrand is appealing for more support and urgent action to avoid a looming humanitarian crisis. He said a recent contribution of $1.5 million from the UN's Emergency Response Fund will support ongoing operations in Kenya to control the outbreak.
An aircraft will therefore keep operating in Kenya for an additional 2 months or so. But we need more resources for other countries as well, especially Ethiopia, Somalia, Sudan, and also Yemen. In fact, FAO faces a funding shortfall of around $34 million in 2021 to maintain the operation. It would be really catastrophic for farmers and herders if we have to stop the surveillance and control operation due to lack of resources.
The UN agency says more swarms are expected to spread further from southern Ethiopia to northern and eastern counties of Kenya. Kenyan authorities say they have put measures in place to deal with the situation. Appearing recently on a local television show, government spokesman Cyrus Oguna gave more details.
There's a lot that is being done to ensure that the locusts do not necessarily invade other counties away from where they currently are. You know, during the first wave, certainly there was cash transfers that were given to those that affected, and therefore this second wave will be treated in the manner that the first wave was treated. Assessment indeed is being made to determine who are the affected persons and the extent to which they can be assisted.
Keith Chrisman, FAO's senior locust forecasting officer, says governments in the region are better prepared to address the problem this time.
Well, last year at this time, we were in a very, very precarious situation. Huge numbers of locust swarms had developed and they were moving and invading, you know, countries that had not seen locusts for 70 years. Here we are in January 2021. It means we have everything in place. Yes, we do have shortages of funding to keep those operations going, and this is extremely critical. But at least we're not at the stage of having to look for aircraft, having to order equipment from abroad. And
UN officials urge governments of affected countries to continue surveillance and control operations to tackle the threat. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa's music from our African collection. But first, after 3 years of bureaucratic wrangling, a healthy female leopard was finally flown from South Africa to Mozambique's Ngorongosa National Park. She made a three-hour flight in a custom wooden crate and was set free into the heart of the 4,000-square-kilometer park. Wildlife specialists hope that she will produce enough cubs with the Ngorongosa's one male leopard to begin to restore Ngorongosa's once teeming carnivore population, which was decimated during Mozambique's 15-year civil war. To find out more about the leopard's arrival and what it means to the complex ecosystem, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Paola Bule, Ngorongosa's assistant director of conservation and the head of its large carnivore restoration project.
A leopard is actually one of the most widespread cats on Earth. In Africa, it is our only spotted large cat. They are a solitary cat, primarily nocturnal, and they tend to be unseen, but they're very much there. They're increasingly threatened and even facing endangerment because of loss of habitat and the impacts of hunting, both legal and illegal hunting.
Are leopards dangerous to people?
Well, they're not dangerous to people at all. They usually take small-bodied mammals, so like your impala and bushbuck and other small mammals that they've evolved over hundreds of thousands of years to hunt as part of these ecosystems.
It was quite some achievement to get her to you from South Africa, wasn't it?
Yeah, because it was such a difficult process for us. During one of the worst years most of us have experienced in a long time during this COVID-19 year, we managed to find a break in the permitting process, and before we knew it, we were flying one of the most beautiful animals I've ever seen across two international borders and giving her a safe home. And she's going to be the first of, we hope, many more to come, including hopefully the first cubs to be born in Ngorongosa National Park in a very long time. So we're closely monitoring that.
When she finally arrived in this huge crate from South Africa, what was your first experience of her?
When she landed in this crate and we were just moments away from releasing her, there were these peepholes in the top of the crate where I could actually see her and like look her in the eye. And at one point she locked eyes with me and just let out this roar, which froze me to death. I mean, it was awe-inspiring. I felt it in my hands. I was actually holding the lid of the crate down.
Tell us more about what she looks like.
She's incredibly beautiful. She has these huge piercing eyes, long whiskers, and this beautiful colored spotted coat.
What color is her coat?
It's like an orange, gold, white, black coloration. So leopardy?
It sounds like you've already developed a bond.
You know, for one thing, I have an immense respect for her. She's made a long, long journey, and she's really sort of the frontier of this incredible recovery effort that's underway to really make a positive difference in terms of protecting biodiversity and turning the tide against extinction.
How confident are you that she will bear more leopard cubs to help repopulate the park?
In a sense, it is experimental. We did release her within range of a male that we've been tracking for a couple of years, so I don't think she'll have any problem pairing up with the male when they meet. But to really jumpstart a population, you need numbers, you need momentum. And so at this stage, she's really opened that door for us to show that we have the right kind of space for these animals to thrive. And so she needs to be the first of many more that we fly over to really get this population going.
I know you're counting on these leopards to prey on the baboons in Ngorongosa.
Absolutely. That's one of the ecological functions. They don't primarily prey on baboons, but they are the primary predator of baboons. And Ngorongosa is notorious for its very large and widespread baboon troops. I mean, we have more than 200 troops in the park, and so that's thousands of baboons. And they've grown a bit lazy. Around dusk, you know, they'll hang out on the ground and they don't go up into the trees so quickly. And that is a sign to us of a missing element. In this case, it would be predation by a leopard. So I think they're going to be changing their behavior pretty soon now that she's around town.
Paola Bule is Assistant Director of Conservation in Mozambique's Gorongosa National Park and the head of its large carnivore restoration project. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Give me love. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. I will give you the world. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. I will tell my mommy. Hallelujah, tell your daddy. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. And if you give me love. I know the tire, I swear I know the tire for your love. Kazi atalonge na bina usawa munyenge Inyolo sibi lobeni mumusima
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Umare Jingerita Shakasali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a sinking vessel needs no navigation. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.